Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Conservatives on the ISU campus try to unite ahead of the November election. We'll bring you the latest in WGLT's Democracy's Future series coming up on WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas. Good evening, I'm John Norton. Also on today's show, a statewide survey shows just how much schools are struggling to find teachers.
Well, I think the attention that it's getting, the conditions are right for the trajectory to change.
And Coalescence Theater brings Panther Women to Bloomington.
Although they are Black women, there is always something you can find in any person where you're like, I can relate to that.
Those stories follow a Bloomington Normal News update just ahead. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, part of the NPR network.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. Here My Story continues with local patients Ralph and Carol Weisite.
I do like the feature that allows you to adjust the direction that the sound is coming from. Really is helpful in just being able to have a good conversation with somebody.
Ralph and Carol's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
On the campus of Illinois State University in Normal, this is WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. As the Republican Party tries to win back the White House, it's trying to attract more younger voters. It's a group that has tended to vote Democrat. WGLT's Democracy's Future podcast spoke to several conservative and right-leaning students on the ISU campus and found a wide spectrum of opinions. Some are calling for everybody getting along. Others paint a much darker picture of the country's future. WGLT's student reporter Braden Fogerson has the story.
As has become a growing theme in today's politics, polarization is a growing issue to those trying to make change from their college campuses. Ross Vansel is a sophomore legal studies and political science double major from Illinois State. He's from Stronghurst, Illinois, 2 hours west of Bloomington Normal. He says the divide has slowed down policymaking.
Sides used to be able to come together and have compromise and work together on more issues, and now it is more polarized, and the sides make each other out to be enemies, and it's not productive, and that has led to some inability for the government and political parties to actually get meaningful things done.
Vansel is president of College Republicans at Illinois State University. His group endorses and canvasses for Republican candidates. Vansel says he's particularly excited to campaign for Desi Anderson, a candidate he worked for once before during her state Senate campaign against Peoria's Dave Kaler in 2022. This election cycle has her running against another incumbent in Sharon Chung for the 91st House District. That includes parts of Bloomington Normal. Vansel says he enjoys being able to have opportunities to personally meet with those in his community.
It's nice to be able to see the people that are excited about your candidate and going to vote and share some maybe stories that they have. And it was just interesting to see some people who were not as excited to see you as a canvasser come up, but it was overall a great experience and a great experience in the political field.
Vansel says he doesn't see issues as left or right, but through his lens as a Christian. Another student whose political activism is inspired by his religious faith is president of Students for Life America at ISU, Braden Gonzalez, a political science major from Frankfort, Illinois, near Joliet. Students for Life is an anti-abortion advocacy group.
Our students on campus, they're so broken people. I just want to go up and I just want to hug them. I'm like, it's okay. Jesus loves you. But I think it can be achieved if America comes back to its religious roots. I think that's when we start loving each other again.
To Gonzalez, his conservative values are where he finds purpose.
I think happiness comes from self-responsibility and gratitude, which is just values not taught by today's left. And so I think happier people are just going to be more conservative.
That worldview was rooted in the story of Gonzalez's father, who fled political persecution from the Philippines to come to the United States. Gonzalez says his brother sees it as a sign that the U.S. should make the American dream easier to achieve. Braden sees it differently.
My brother would say, well, you know, you just got lucky. And on top of that, if it wasn't luck, you shouldn't have to work that hard to succeed like that. And I couldn't disagree more. I feel like that's a great way to live a very unhappy life.
Gonzalez says other chapters of Students for Life America led the push for Florida Governor Ron DeSantis to get on board with a ban on any abortions later than 6 weeks into pregnancy. A Florida Supreme Court ruling upheld that law the first of this month, ending a legal battle that began when the bill was signed into law a year ago. Florida voters will decide later this year whether to keep the six-week ban. Former President Trump has raised some objections to this and similar abortion restrictions.
That man called DeSantis's abortion ban disgusting, which is repulsive for him to say that because he's like, I'm the most pro-life president ever.
Gonzalez disagrees with the former president on this issue, but he says he still plans to vote for him come November. Gonzalez adds, though he supported DeSantis in the primaries, he accepts that in this moment, the Republican Party still belongs to Trump.
I think Trump's going to win, and it will be because we ignored these people. We ignored his supporters for so long. And so I will never go after his supporters because they have almost every right to think what they think. And that's why Trump has this like cult following.
Some of Trump's most fervent supporters can be found in far-right groups such as Turning Point USA. It's a nonprofit organization that promotes conservative politics on high school and college campuses. One of Turning Point's founders, Charlie Kirk, also promotes Christian nationalism and various conspiracy theories, including false claims of a stolen presidential election in 2020. Riley Wassler is a physics major from the Chicago suburb of Darien and is president of Turning Point USA at ISU. Wassler says he would eliminate any diversity efforts in the U.S. government.
And then reinstate a meritocracy instead of we need to meet quotas, because you want a strong federal government for when the country's under attack or there's a national security risk or something similar.
Wassler speculates without any evidence that the U.S. military will eventually have to defend itself from an influx of immigrants coming into the U.S. The Anti-Defamation League and Southern Poverty Law Center have criticized Turning Point USA for its ties to far-right activists. I'm Braden Fogerson.
Interviews were conducted by Vedette reporters Paul Aguilar and Maggie Blyer as part of Democracy's Future podcast series. Democracy's Future is a collaboration between student reporters at WGLT News and The Vedette. You can subscribe to Democracy's Future on the NPR app or wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up next week on Sound Ideas, you'll get an update on the Bloomington Public Library expansion. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT. I'm John Norton. A new survey of school administrators shows the short and long-term challenges to education in Illinois. Gary Tipsord knows those challenges well. He served as superintendent of Leroy Schools, southeast of Bloomington Normal, for 16 years before he retired last spring. Now he's the executive director of the Illinois Association of Regional School Superintendents of Schools. That group's recent survey shows more than 90% of schools responding reported having a serious or very serious teacher shortage problem. In this conversation with Jennifer Fuller from Capital News Illinois, Tipsord says those findings are nothing new, as recent surveys have raised similar concerns.
I think what you're seeing in terms of consistency in the feedback from the field is a concern that we need to address long-term sustainable solutions. And so I think in particular, the consistency of the feedback, that 90% having a concern, is probably reflective of a forward-looking vision as much as anything. And obviously not to minimize the what we're trying to deal with right now, but I think it is clearly indicative of that looking forward.
As with so many things, this is a really complicated issue. There's not just one thing you can point to in terms of why there is a teacher shortage. We're looking at things like how many students are in the pipeline in college studying to be future teachers, teacher pay, burnout, other issues like that. If there was one way that you could describe that for people who are not a part of education, how would you describe that?
Yeah, so the pipeline side, so I think you have to look at it in two areas, right? So the front end, are we creating a supply that is big enough to meet the demand with enough volume that also incentivizes competition? Because then not only are you getting enough teachers and paraprofessionals, speech language folks, all of those pieces, but it's also competitive enough that we're getting the best that are filling these roles. But then once they're in the profession, how do we better understand the working conditions that affirm for the people working in public education that they're valued, that they're appreciated, and that their work makes a difference. I think that's that area of focus for existing staff that we need to better understand and we need to be more attentive to.
It seems often that the way a lot of people say they want to be appreciated is through pay. And I know that the state is several years into the new evidence-based funding model where struggling schools are perhaps getting a larger portion of state funding in order to try and level that playing field. Is that helping?
Yeah, well, it's certainly helping. It's creating more predictability for school districts to build budgets because they know with the base funding minimum and the way that that's been conceptualized, that they know year over year what they can count on. But I think the other important thing to realize about EBF, where increasing teacher wages is clearly a factor and relevant in some places, it's not relevant necessarily in all. Then we have some districts around the state that have very competitive salary schedules. But it does speak to the concept of working conditions. So what do the supportive services look like that make things better for our students and better for our teachers and our staff? What do class sizes look like according to the model? So the model not only provides resources for funding, but it also provides resources so we can design an educational environment that's better for our students, clearly, but also better for our staff that deliver those services.
So for people who are not familiar with the educational environment, what do some of those things look like? Are we talking about school counselors, teachers' aides, you know, additional supportive measures? Or is it really boiling down to more teachers or better structures or things like that?
Well, I think all of that. I think it's a really comprehensive picture, because if I simply look at it through the lens of what EBF does prescriptively, so if I think of our funding model and what that delivers to our schools, it is also right-sizing your classrooms. So student enrollment, how many students should be in a class? How many counselors are needed? How many paraprofessionals are needed to deal with the unique environment in every unique school district in the state of Illinois? It's not saying that every building in every school district should look the same. What it is suggesting is that there's an optimal place for them to be and to be staffed and to have the right type of programming and support services for the students that they are specifically responsible to serve. And so the closer we get to optimal, logic would suggest that they will function more effectively, they will function better, will be better in the interest of students, but also in a better interest of the adults that are working in that environment as well.
Two more issues that I wanted to talk about, and they both kind of look forward. First of all, what is it that the legislature can or should do in order to bring these environments into reality and make sure that some of these needs are being addressed?
I think the first is to continue to collect the data, to continue to use the survey that I anticipate we'll continue to put together on an annual basis. And then be able to have just honest, forthright conversations about what they think these implications are and how can we create solutions that at the end of the day are in the best interest of the students that we're responsible to serve, right? So actually being able to engage in honest, forthright dialogue about solutions, I think, is critical. But I think the other piece, they've built in certain flexibilities that have allowed us to be responsive in the moment to the challenges that are in front of us, making some of those things more permanent in the structure so that school districts and even in our situation at the regional office level or the intermediate service center level, that there's some predictability that we know you can solve some problems in your classrooms a certain way, right? So more sustainability with that, I think, is important. And then at some point in time, we've got to look at how we provide structures for students that are in junior high and high school to begin to explore and aspire to positions in education.
Finally, I wonder about the picture. Your survey has been going on for about 7 years now. If we were to look 7 to 10 years into the future, given the trajectory that the state is on right now, does the survey look very different in 5 to 10 years? Or is there something that people should be extremely concerned about when it comes to this teacher shortage?
Well, I think the attention that it's getting, the conditions are right for the trajectory to change. But at some point in time, there are people that are going to have to make hard decisions that will open greater doors of opportunity. They may have to build different systems than have existed before.
That was Gary Tipsord from the Illinois Association of Regional School Superintendents of Schools, speaking with Jennifer Fuller from Capital News, Illinois. The Illinois legislature has set up a working group to figure out ways to address the statewide teacher shortage. Representative Sharon Chong of Bloomington is serving on that panel. Thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas. This is WGLT's News Magazine. Theater director and Baton Rouge native Myesha Tierra weathered the pandemic in Chicago. That's where she formed her own theater company and spent 3 years working on a Jeff-nominated production of India Nicole Burton's Panther Women, An Army for the Liberation. But Myesha Tierra doesn't like to stay in one place very long, so she jumped at the chance to stage Panther Women on Coalescence Theater Project. She tells WGLT's Lauren Wernicke, artistic director Don Chandro approached her in Chicago and said they had to get it in Bloomington Normal.
And I was like, I have no idea where that is. But I said, okay, cool, let's talk about it. And I reached out to India, and Don reached out to India about it. And we had a couple of meetings in Chicago about bringing it up to Bloomington Normal. And instead of keeping the same cast, allowing the people that are in Bloomington Normal, those actors, to get an opportunity to experience this show and make it their own.
How are you imagining the space that you're going to be using, staying true to the production, while also, as you said, reimagining it for this cast, this space, this community?
So we are going to be in a church rec area, which is kind of like a side building, which a lot of churches have that are just there for when they need productions or when they're holding any kind of banquets and things like that. So that space is much bigger than the Davis space, which is actually an office space that we turned into a dilapidated Black Panther office. So what we're going to do is actually cut the room off by creating walls so that it makes it a smaller space, but also by having the set design where it encloses everyone in, so it gives that feeling of being closer together while also having those outside elements of the rec room, church, the stained glass windows, and all, keeping all of that still there to like give a dilapidated, you know, church space instead of Black Panther office. So it's kind of like, for this show, you can put it in any found space you like as long as you work with it and not against it.
There's kind of a partnership here with, what is it, the Black Artists League at ISU, so a lot of young folks, college students. How's the experience been so far?
It's been a really interesting experience. I have a mixed bag of actors. So I have some actors who are about to graduate with degrees in theater, some actors who just got there in their degree in theater who are, you know, second year. I have some who are professional actors who like try to do this professionally in Bloomington Normal and maybe other places. And then I have some actors who are actually, this is their first major big production that they've ever been a part of. So being able to understand how each person works and then find a way to make sure we can all work together cohesively so that they can get what they need out of it and I can get what I need as a director and make sure I stay true as possible to India's work and the feel that she wants for this show.
What is it that you need?
What I really want and need from this production is the ability to walk into this space for my audience and to see an entirely different world. But not only that, not see these women, because Black, you know, Black Panthers, we say Black Panther, Panther women, and automatically we think of just that movement. We don't think of these people as individuals. Our main ladies are Angela Davis, Elaine Brown, and Asada Shakur. And a lot of people only know a few things, very few things about them, and just Black Panther Party affiliation is all you have. But this play, which India does a really beautiful job of doing, goes into who they were as children and then goes up into where their affiliation begins. So we actually get to see them as a complete and whole person, which is actually one of the lines from the show, is I am a complete and whole person, and seeing them as actual women in the world.
I would love for you to maybe talk a little bit about some of the tension between women in the Black Panther Party. I know specifically Elaine Brown faced a lot of sexism as she was rising to leadership in this party and got out as a result of it. So we see this both as a platform for women's empowerment and Black empowerment, but also a vehicle for their own oppression in some ways.
A big part of that is I think sometimes people often want to see only one side of a group and they don't see the fact that it's a very layered group. The Black Panthers did do a lot of great things, like, you know, the food services, the helping of the children, the breakfast programs, the getting the being their own version of an emergency vehicle to get people to and from the hospital, literacy, all those great things. However, within that party, there were some dark times where there was sexism, there was misogyny, where these women were seen as less than, depending on which Black Panther man you were dealing with that day, you know. And for Elaine Brown, who was very big behind the scenes with helping with funding for the party, I've read her autobiography and it's really good. If you have the time, it's like 600 pages, so you have to have the time, you know. It's not a quick read by any means, but it really delves really deep into the party as a whole and in the unfortunate circumstances, not only herself but Asada and Angela, who was not a Black Panther but was affiliated, what they, who are the ones we know the names, but there are so many other women whose names we may not know that were part of the party that had to deal with misogyny and sexism and being seen as less than just because you're a woman, even though a lot of the women were the ones who were coming up with the really great ideas for all of the programs that were helping push the Black Panthers into a space where they were able to get more funding. Throughout this story, there is a character named Journey who goes on her own journey, pun intended, to to see where she came from and see the shoulders she's standing on. When she arrives, she's very downtrodden. She's had very rough experience before we see her. And she's kind of just over it and wants to end it all. And when she cries out to her ancestors for some guidance and some help, these six women come out of nowhere, like these muses that come from the space because they hear her and they help her guide on her journey, and knowing that it's okay to be mad, it's okay to be happy, it's okay to be sad, it's okay to be confused, it's okay to not understand what your next steps are, because these women that came before you all experienced this already.
How are they responding to the material and going on their own journeys relating to these women's stories?
I think a big thing for them, it's getting that confidence and realizing that, oh man, I can do it and that I'm able to accomplish these things. And not only that, they may have felt as if they weren't seen. And now this is a show where all six of them, or seven including Journey, have the opportunity to have moments where they're highlighted and everyone's looking at them and they're experiencing their own form of activism, of course, with this show, but own form of just self-love and self-discovery, which is what I also want the audience to be able to find themselves in, one of these seven women, because although they are Black women, there is always something you can find in any person where you're like, I can relate to that.
Panther Women, an Army for the Liberation opens next week at First Christian Church in Bloomington. Director Myesha Tierra spoke with WGLT's Lauren Warnicki.
Support for arts and culture coverage on WGLT comes from PNC Financial Services. PNC is committed to supporting local arts and culture events in the communities they serve.
And that's Sound Ideas Today. WGLT's news magazine is made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm John Norton. Story help today came from WGLT's Lauren Warnicki and student reporter Braden Fogerson. Ryan Toohey edits Sound Ideas. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, part of the NPR network.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.